I'm Margaret Worthington. I'm a new freight forwarder working at the University of Arkansas, working closely with John Clark, and I also work on rose breed. We have a lot of crops that we work on. Here I'm not presenting on the rose breed date. I give that to Maxwell to present on the peaches, but we also have a program on muscadine grapes, so very exciting stuff, and I will talk a little bit about that. So first of all, a little information on what is a muscadine grape. It's the first cultivated grape in North America, and they're native to the southeastern U.S. They're really popular where I grew up in eastern North Carolina, that they're in every farmer's market, in the Walmart even, in all the grocery stores, and the roadside stands every September. The fruit is very large and aromatic and flavorful. I really like it. It's also very disease resistant, and it's well adapted to our climate, so it's something that is relatively easy for growers in the southeast compared to growing a vinifera or another uvitis grape in terms of the spray requirements. And the downside to muscadine grapes that I see is perhaps their skins. They have thick, leathery skins and soft flesh. I've heard people describe the texture and with a couple terms that are not going to help us sell any muscadine. People have said it's like biting into an eyeball. I've gotten oyster, snot. Well, I really like oysters, and I'm a sophisticated person, so I like the texture of muscadine grapes, but we're going to try and breed one that even a Yankee could love. As Shunzun said yesterday, they are related to your uvitis grapes like Vitis vinifera, but they're in a different subgenus. They're in subgenus Muscadinia, and they actually have an extra chromosome. So the diploid chromosome number of uvitis grapes is 38, and ours is 40. So it's difficult to get crosses between uvitis and muscadine grapes, but it is possible and has been achieved, and it's a way. Muscadine have been a source of important powdery mildew resistance genes like RUN1 that are widely utilized in Vitis vinifera breeding programs. So our breeding program is relatively new. It started in 2007. The idea, you know, we had a long, successful grape program that's still ongoing with the idea to make an eastern grape breeding, or eastern table grape industry, right? And then eventually we're like, okay, well, we already have an eastern table grape that is delicious, and it's called the muscadine. So John started this program in 2007. Since then, we've planted about 14,000 seedlings, and we've made, well, this is an old slide. Now we've made 212 selections, I should update. But we have a group of advanced selections that we're excited about moving along, but no cultivars yet since we are only 11 years old, the program. We have an emphasis on improving consumer quality while retaining adaptation and disease resistance. And our program has a specific focus on cold tolerance. Here you can see kind of the range that muscadines are adapted across the southeast. And we're here, not here, Maxwell, but here in Clarksville. So right on the border, we get a lot of cold injury when temperatures dip below 10 degrees Fahrenheit in muscadines. And we get that every once in a while, every couple of years, we get temperatures that dip down really low. So we have a nice opportunity to complement what Patrick Connor is doing in Georgia, where he doesn't ever get to select for cold tolerance. We have a good selection environment. I'm also going to mention that we have females and perfect flowered selections in muscadine, and this is relevant to this talk based on some marker work that we've done, and I'll describe here. So we're making gains, improving the texture and the quality of muscadine grapes while retaining this adaptation slowly but surely. But, you know, compared to all of the nice work that you presented on strawberries and all those markers, we don't really have very much. So our goal was to try and start developing some more molecular resources for muscadine grapes. We have a really nice opportunity because we are closely related to uvitis grapes, and people like Bruce have been working so hard to develop nice tools for us to copy. So we have a nice opportunity there. The best available maps before we started this project were very sparse and constructed only with microsatellites. So two biparental mapping populations, F1s, were developed between different cultivars, Black Beauty by Nesbitt and Supreme by Nesbitt. both of the female parents here, pistillate flowered, crossed to a perfect flowered selection, and we expect to see a one-to-one ratio of females to perfect flowers when we make those crosses. And we routinely use females in our process because it's very difficult to emasculate muscadine, so it's a nice thing to have females. But you obviously don't want to release a female because then you have to have a pollinizer, so they're basically just used for crossing material. All the parents were black, but they were all heterozygous, so we had a 3-to-1 ratio of black to bronze in our populations. So our goals were to build dense linkage maps of muscadine using genotyping by sequencing, and we would map genetic loci for flower sex and berry color. And we also were going to do QTL mapping, and here I'll talk about fruit size and cold hardiness. I'll go over a little bit of the other information. John's student Jennifer Luter presented information about the linkage maps and the flower sex and berry color information last year, but it was at 5 o'clock on Friday in Hawaii, and there was a significantly smaller population there than there is here right now. I forgive you all. I'll go over it again. So the traits that we measured were sex and berry color, and berry color was measured just as black or bronze, a qualitative trait, and those were done in 2011 and 2012, as well as berry weight on a 10-berry sample. And then the winter injury was done just these past 2 years. Obviously, these are pretty old vines at this point, but we've had some really nice selection pressure for cold hardiness in the last couple of years, so we had the opportunity to do some phenotyping. So our phenotyping for cold hardiness, we phenotyped on a 1-to-5 scale. This last year, we did it on May 23rd. Actually, Maxwell did the phenotyping for us because I got married 4 days after that, so I was away. So thanks, Maxwell. And then in June the year before, and our scale was basically, you know, full death of the vine or imminent collapse as a 1, significant damage to the cordons as a 2, heavy damage to spurs as a 3, slight damage to spurs as a 4, and then a completely healthy vine was rated as a 5, and we had a lot of good segregation. So our genetic linkage maps, we had the 2 mapping populations, and we used them together to create a consensus map. It had 2,346 markers over our 20 linkage groups. As you can see here, they're pretty well dispersed. The markers that are in blue are the ones that were segregating only in Black Beauty by Nesbitt. The ones in red were segregating in Supreme by Nesbitt, and the markers in black were segregating in both populations. So our total linkage map was about 2,100 centimorgans. So we have about 1 marker per 0.92 centimorgans here. As you can see here, our synteny with Vitis vinifera was really good, generally pretty collinear across the genome there. And here you can see our explanation for our extra chromosome that we have compared to Vitis vinifera. It's a pretty clear split. And this had been shown in previous SSR-based maps, but we were able to use these maps to define it to a pretty tight little interval there so that we know that the split between linkage group 7 and 20 there occurs between 14.33 and 14.32 megabase pairs. We looked in this region to try and find telomeric repeats and decide who was ancestral. I didn't find anything. But live and learn. We'll see if we find something down the line. Then we mapped the sex locus. Sex did fit a segregation ratio of 1-to-1 in the Black Beauty by Nesbitt population, but it was pretty distorted with an excess of perfect flowered progeny and Supreme by Nesbitt. We had some slight distortion in the other population, too, with more perfect flowered. So I'm not sure exactly why that is. But nonetheless, we were able to map the sex locus. We also genotyped with the sex markers that Patrick Connor's group had developed based on candidate genes that were developed by Pick et al. In 2014 in uveitis grapes. And they segregated perfectly with sex in all but 1 of our vines, and I'm pretty sure that's a phenotyping error, but that vine is dead, and I can no longer correct it, so too bad. I mean, it's very predicted, perfectly predicted. So the sex locus mapped to 41.76 centimorgans and to a physical interval here that's pretty tight, around 4.64 to 5.09 megabases, and that's exactly where the vitis vinifera sex locus is. We also mapped color, and I was kind of expecting to see color mapped to chromosome 2 as well, because that's where the mid-transcription factors are in grapes, but that's my face when I mapped it. It's on chromosome 4. So we actually mapped the sex locus in both, or the sex locus, color locus, I'm sorry, the color locus in both populations to this area, 68.2 centimorgans, a physical interval of 11.1 to 11.9 megabases. And I'll give credit to Aruna Varanasi, who's an excellent postdoc working in our lab. She looked at predicted genes, and she's identified a candidate gene that is within the anthocyanin biosynthesis pathway, and she's cloning the gene now. She's developed a marker that's perfectly predictive across muscadine germplasm, so we're working on adding all of our nice little spots like you have in strawberry. So the next thing I'll discuss is our berry weight QTL. We had the berry weight measured in 2011 and 2012. And here, the only significant QTL that we had show up was on chromosome 2. And you can see in 2011, it was pretty much right on top of the sex locus there. We have an LOD of about 9 with our significance threshold of 6.5. In 2012, the QTL was even stronger on chromosome 2, but it's about 10 centimorgans proximal to the sex locus in this case. So this isn't really super surprising for us, because females are kind of anecdotally known to be larger on average than perfect flowered selections, and this has been shown in some previous studies. Here you can see that the shift in size isn't huge. You can still get large size perfect flowered selections, but on average they're about a gram to 2 grams bigger, the females, than the perfect flowered, if you look over the different populations and years. So there are several possible factors for the relationship between size and sex, and I'll thank Patrick for consulting with me some on this and the different ideas. You know, I was thinking that it was productivity related, that we had lower yields in the females, and maybe it's like peaches where they are thinned and they grow larger for that. And he referred me to this nice study from 1957 where they show that indeed there is a relationship between sex and size, and there are generally more productivity, like vines that are perfect flowered are generally more productive, but if you look at the vines and their productivity ratings, there isn't really a clear relationship, so it's not that. So there are several other possible factors. It could be pleiotropy, that, you know, there's some sexual dimorphisms where women are better and bigger. There could be a linkage between the sex locus and the berry size gene. And, you know, that could be the case, certainly, because we did see that it was a little bit proximal to our gene in the QTL mapping. And it could also be metaxina. I'm saying that wrong, I'm sure. But the idea that cross-pollination would yield larger fruit on average. So they're a little difficult to say, but the good news is that it's possible to develop large perfect-flowered cultivars like Palk, that's the new release, that is almost as large as Supreme, its very large female parent. So next into the winter injury, I'll be very quick because I see Sujit standing. you know, you can see here that all of three of our parents had quite a bit of winter injury this last year in the vines. Muscadines don't have bud kill in the way that Vitis vinifera does due to cold temperature. It's more like they don't produce antifreeze in their vascular systems, and so you get a crack and you get collapse of an entire cordon or collapse of just spurs there. So, you know, here you can see all of the parents, and then this is our consistent winner, Carlos, a processing selection or processing cultivar that always does very well. Again, that was our rating scale, and we had pretty good, I'll skip ahead here, we had pretty good segregation, so here you can see a look at the population that we had some that were doing quite well, and Supreme by Nesbitt, and others that did much more poorly, and you know, just within the 2 weeks there between these two scorings, a lot of that damage to spurs gets covered up by the vigor, but that damage continues throughout the season that you have lower productivity, so it still is important even if you don't have complete vine collapse. So our QTL that we had here, we have a non-significant QTL that's shown up on linkage group 6, but kind of the same pattern in both years. And there was nothing that showed up on group 20 in 2007, which, sorry, I didn't label that, or 2017 on that side. But it does become significant here in 2018. And I really trust our 2018 data better because it was taken when we could see that spur damage at an earlier time. So there's something there that we can look into a little more. As I said, there are implications for productivity, even though they look to grow out of it. Obviously, this Carlos vine that's next to this Nesbitt vine is going to be a lot healthier in the future and produce more fruit and be less subject to collapse because it does have all of that green biomass. So, let's see. Our conclusions, I think there are lots of exciting opportunities for us in Muscadine to do some comparative genomics work with Vitis vinifera. You know, we found that we have similar things going on in sex, but I think we may have a secondary sex locus also because the perfect flowers, when you self them, they have these interesting segregation ratios that are very different. Obviously, we've shown different genes and anthocyanins are working in muscadines compared to the Vitis vinifera, so there's a lot of discovery work to be done there too. And cold tolerance, I think, as well, because the muscadines have good bud hardiness but poor vascular hardiness, so maybe we can learn something by doing some comparative genomics. We have a lot of interesting directions for future research. I think we have more to do to untangle the relationship between fruit size and sex that we can work on. We certainly could develop mapping populations using Carlos, our actual cold hardy selection, to find these genes for cold hardiness that would be important. And I think that in this population, we didn't study flesh texture and skin texture, but those are high priority traits for us, so things that we need to look into in the future. So thanks to everyone who did the population and the phenotyping, also our genotyping work, which was done with Cornell with Chris Owens when he was there, and everyone who's worked with us on the sex markers and candidate gene analysis as well. I went long, but I'm the last one.
Any questions?
How do you know that the variation you're recording of cold hardiness is not just leaking out day variation?
Well, because even like at the end of the season, you know, this is going on, like we'll still see this difference here between Carlos and Nesbitt that they don't recover. You know, I know that you're... I understand your point that it could be just a kind of a bloom date variation and leafing out time, but you see just general damage and collapse of whole cordons and that sort of thing that you wouldn't.
Then you should have seen the QTL popping up on the other year as well.
This is true, but I think the plants are planted at such close spacing, if I show here. They're at 1 foot spacing, and they kind of grow together by this time. So, you know, if I send a graduate student out to phenotype these guys, you know, 350 vines, I do not know that people get in there and really look for that cordon damage, like, you know, in the way that they might otherwise. But, yeah, I guess I can see your point that it could be confounded with that. But in this case, I feel pretty confident that it is something that we still see to this day out in our field, and you would think that something that just leafs out late would recover and eventually become as productive as, you know, the ones that leaf out early. Well, there's no genome sequence of muscadine, but it's generally thought that muscadine would be basal to vitis, to uvitis because it is in North America and because other related genera like Parthenocissus have the same base number as muscadine. You know, the thing to do would be to look at syntony between Parthenocissus and muscadine, and I think that would get it. Who's going to pay me to sequence Parthenocissus? I don't know. NSF, maybe. I don't think SERI is going to do it. So.
Adam and Eve were trotting around there. Adam liked all that flavor. Eve didn't. God said, I got to send you something else. So they sent the nephrite, the neutral flavor. The phylum didn't all have to work itself out.
The first time I got to know that there was something else existed except the nephra was when I came to U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't like it for the same reasons you listed.
Yeah, you know, I really thought that I was going to find those telomeric sequences right in that region, that I would find evidence that muscadine was indeed basal and that these chromosomes had fused, but I can't answer that with any degree of certainty at this moment. Uh-huh.
So, Margaret, you've got a lot on your plate, obviously, but what about seamlessness?
Well, we're working on it. You know, Jeff Bloodworth is a private breeder in North Carolina in Hillsborough, and he's been toiling in his backyard vineyard for 30 years, crossing muscadines to uvitis grapes, just with the idea that, you know, I think they usually don't take very well, but every once in a while you get that unbalanced gamete and something takes a little bit better than others. So one thing that I'm working on now is that we want to do a project to track introgressions from muscadine to uvitis and back and forth. So I've gotten a collection of material from Jeff and Pat and also the UC Davis folks who are introgressing the resistance genes, and we'll be doing GBS and looking at that. But yes, we are crossing with Jeff Bloodworth's material, so I'm very excited to do that. But he is the one that can toil for 30 years in his backyard vineyard, and hopefully we can just have amazing success with his seedless muscadines, because yes, the seedlessness is a problem, or the seediness is a problem. Muscadine seeds are disgusting and they're huge. So you have to spit out, and it's not very sophisticated looking to be spitting out all those skins and seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.